You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Goldhawk Fights Back for You on AM 740 Zoomer Radio. Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740 Zoomer Radio.
It's almost 18 minutes after 12 on Zoomer Radio. Time to say hello once again to Dr. Zach. Hi, Dr. Zach.
Hello, Dale.
Today we're going to talk about cardiovascular risks, of which there are quite a few, right?
Absolutely. And I think people probably know them, even if they don't consciously know them. We certainly speak of them whenever we speak of any kind of, when we talk about heart attacks, when you talk about strokes, when you talk about kidney disease, high blood pressure. Those are all, they all fall into that category of cardiovascular health and cardiovascular disease.
Can we prioritize them? Is there one risk that is higher than others?
I think the top two, if I had to, or let's make it the top three, would be high blood pressure, high cholesterol, hyperlipidemia, and smoking.
And smoking.
And the nice thing about those is that, in large part, they're controllable. Other ones, you know, that we live with are our family history, our genetics, our gender, our age, and those things we can't do too much about.
What about something like type 2 diabetes?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's right up there. Some people would even put it within the top three.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's many others. You know, there's obesity, and there's diabetes, and even certainly lack of physical activity. And,
yeah, well, that's what I said earlier. I said a bad case of couch potato-ism.
Yeah, absolutely. But unfortunately, diabetes, there is some behavioral, I mean, you can decrease your risk, as we've talked about before, with diet and exercise. But to a certain extent, you know, a fair number of people have diabetes, and they through no fault of their own. But there is still a role for diet and exercise in improving your diabetes control. But anyway, to answer your question, definitely having diabetes does increase your risk for disease. Yeah.
Let's go back over the talk. First off, you talked about smoking. Mm. Smoking does so many terrible things to our body. I'm not sure everybody realizes it also has an effect on your cardiovascular health as well.
Oh, it's very important people know that. I mean, smoking is one of the major causes. It increases, after a few years of smoking, your risk of heart attack and stroke increases by a good 200%. And it's, of course, the whole thing is preventable. And the good news is also that when you quit smoking, with time, it's not right away, but over 5 to 10 years, your risk goes down precipitously, almost to the risk that you would have had you never smoked. So it's not necessarily a permanent damage you've done, but you have to get off the smoking.
It's amazing, is it not, how the human body can repair itself that way?
Absolutely, and as you know, not all parts of the body can do that. You know, there's certain parts of the body that are better than others at repairing themselves, and the lungs do have some of that capacity.
Yeah, although the risk never totally goes away, I'm assuming, even in later
years. It depends how long you've smoked for, and it depends if there has been, you know, if you have developed emphysema or chronic bronchitis. Some of those, you can have permanent changes to the lung structure. But in many people, many people do get lucky, and they haven't made permanent damage.
Yeah. Now, and some of the other risk factors. Let's talk about high blood pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so high blood pressure is very common. It's about 20% of the world's adults have it. And basically, blood pressure, we've all had our blood pressure checked. You get the cuff that goes around your arm, and it measures the pressure in your arteries as your heart pumps. And the top number, the systolic, is when your heart is contracting, so the blood is being forced through. And the bottom number, which is the diastolic, is when your heart is relaxing, so the blood is still moving but at a more leisurely pace.
Right.
And in general, the cutoff for high blood pressure is the top number being over 140 and or the bottom number being over 90, and about 20%, world over, about 20% of the world's adults have high blood pressure. In Canada, it's about 22%.
22%, oh, great. Oh.
Yeah, and it does, your risk does increase with age, but, you know, just to put a number on it, we're talking about a billion people who have hypertension, and the majority, one of the problems is the majority of it is not A, detected, and B, treated effectively.
Well, you talk high blood pressure, and then you say hypertension. Describe that for me. I'm not sure I know what that means.
Oh, okay, yeah. So hypertension, it's actually the same thing. It's just the medical word for high blood pressure.
All right, okay.
And the only thing is there are other forms of hypertension. When doctors say hypertension, for the most part, they're talking about high arterial blood pressure. But you can have high pressures in other areas. So we've mentioned before pulmonary hypertension, which means increased pressures in your lungs, and you can have hypertension elsewhere. But in general, when we talk about hypertension, when doctors say that, they're talking about your blood pressure in your arteries
being too high. Some people also suffer from the fact they have low blood pressure. Does that have any cardiovascular implications?
Actually, I'm glad you brought it up. You know, it doesn't get much play, but we certainly see a lot of it. It's not dangerous in the sense that it doesn't increase your risk for a heart attack. You know, a lot of what we're seeing now, and we've talked about it a little bit, is the risk that inflammation and constant barrage and stress has on different parts of the body, and high blood pressure is sort of like that. It's always pushing, putting a lot of stress on the arteries, and it does relate also. We can talk about atherosclerosis later, or what's also called hardening of the arteries.
Right.
But there are a fair number of people, and it tends to be more common in slim people and in women who have low blood pressure. The risk there is that often when your blood pressure gets too low, you don't have enough blood circulation to the brain, and those people often get dizzy spells. They can even have the risk of passing out, falling, hurting themselves. So it doesn't increase your risk for heart disease, but it's something.
But it has its own risks. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we see people all the time in the emergency department whose blood pressure, for whatever reason, sometimes it's just how they are, but often it's because they're on medications. Sometimes it's because they have a bad infection. Their blood pressure is too low, and it can have very significant effects. And oftentimes the first treatment for it is hydration. Oftentimes people are a little bit dehydrated, and they just need more fluid in their system.
All right. Now, high blood pressure, how effectively can it be controlled by medication?
It can be, in most people, I mean, in the high 90s%, it can be very effectively treated with medication. As people probably, I'm sure there are listeners who are on different medications. There are a whole host of different medications available, and they should be, they are, and they should be chosen depending on your health history and how, precisely to your needs. So the first thing is always, we always talk about this, but the first treatment is always, you know, diet and exercise, because there's no question if you're more active, if you lose the extra few pounds, your blood pressure will go down. But then if you need medications, because there's so many different classes of medications, the vast majority of people can be controlled on medication. But unfortunately, some people need more than one medication, sometimes 3, 4, 5 before the blood pressure is controlled. In some people, it's really necessary.
Does that include the group of drugs known as statins? Are they for high blood pressure?
They're not for high blood pressure, but they're very closely linked. The statins are for cholesterol.
Oh, I got you.
And very, very commonly the same people, if you have high blood pressure or you're overweight or you have a risk for heart disease, you're getting your cholesterol checked. And very often you'll be on a statin to control your cholesterol and one of the medications, which we can go through the different classes, for blood pressure as well. And they've actually talked about, they don't have it now, but there has been discussion of putting a pill together that has a statin, aspirin, and an anti-hypertension.
A magic high blood pressure pill, right?
Exactly. So people don't want to take 5 different medications if they can take one.
What do you, I've been dying to ask you this for a number of weeks now, and I never seem to get around to it. What's the relationship between dietary cholesterol and serum cholesterol?
Yeah. Well, the relationship is so if you do have a diet that is high in especially saturated fats, and certainly what we have discussed in the past is trans fats, so that everyone agrees on.
They're the real evil ones. Yes, yes.
Yeah, those are the real baddies.
Yeah.
If you have a diet that's high in those, you have a higher risk of having increased level of bad cholesterol in your blood. So there's the good cholesterol, the HDL, the high density lipoproteins, but there's the primary bad cholesterol is the low density lipoprotein. And that's the one that increases atherosclerosis. That's the one that gets embedded in the walls of people's arteries. So that's atherosclerosis is where you get those plaques on the on the sides of arteries that can narrow the artery and that can eventually rupture and actually block the artery. And that's either they block the artery, or if they rupture, they can embolize, which means they can float somewhere else and cause a stroke or something like that.
But I keep hearing this argument about the fact, well, your cholesterol intake, and maybe we would take trans fat out of that equation for a minute, that sure. Your cholesterol, your dietary intake of cholesterol doesn't necessarily dictate how much cholesterol is going to wind up in your bloodstream, depending upon your lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few things there. Number one, lifestyle. It definitely mitigates. It's definitely a mitigating factor. So
yeah.
If you're very active, you do get a little more leeway in terms of what your body can take in, and you'll still not have as high bad cholesterol. The other thing is, and we just can't fight this, is genetics. You know, there are some people who are just very prone, even with a great diet, to have high cholesterol. And there are genetic syndromes even. I'm not even, you know, there's just, your family history. But there's also syndromes where people have familial hypertriglyceridemia or familial hyperlipidemia. And those, unfortunately, the relationship there, there's not much you can do. Those people usually need medications, no matter how active or how good their diet is.
Okay. Now, so we've covered then, I think, most of the major, have we missed any of the cardiovascular risks that we've not talked about?
No, I think the main ones that we've covered, you know, the high blood pressure or hypertension, the diabetes, and then the whole family of atherosclerosis is, but the risk factors for atherosclerosis are similar, you know, they're the same as the risk factors for cardiovascular disease because they're almost one and the same. Their diabetes, their lipids, their hypertension, age, gender, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, and
all diet. Comes back to the same things, doesn't it? Once again,
you know, it's amazing. It's almost whenever we get talking about anything, I think we'll be speaking about a whole new subject. But then there's always that that lifestyle factor in there.
We always seem to return to the base camp, I think,
yeah.
and that's we got, you know, these bodies that we have, these wonderful machines. We got to look after them.
Well, it's nice, you know. I mean, it is nice that we have some control over these things, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And it certainly is, once people start getting into shape and getting more active, they feel better. And not only do they feel better, but when we actually test them, we check their blood pressure, we check their cholesterol, we actually find that they are healthier.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that you could see in the ER someday somebody come in with some kind of cardiovascular problem and they look to be in great shape. Maybe they have high blood. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't. There's nothing magic about that. You could still have these problems regardless of the fact you've done everything you can to look after yourself.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So like everything else, we speak in generalities, and in general, you absolutely, across the population, the people who eat better and who are more physically active are healthier, and they live longer, and they have better quality of life. They're able to do more.
Yeah, it's not so much the living longer, it's the living better, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Or I guess it's a little of both. I'm hoping it's a little of both.
Oh, absolutely. But I agree with you. I mean, if you have a lot of longevity with no quality of life, then some people would argue.
Who was it who said if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself?
Yeah, exactly. but unfortunately, there's always outliers, and those are the ones that are, and we always see them. And the other thing is we always notice them as doctors and as patients also. We notice the young people who, we always hear stories about the people who ran marathons and ate great and then dropped dead of a heart attack at a young age. And those are the ones we remember. And unfortunately, they definitely happen, you know, and you can't fight your genes. And also sometimes, for whatever reason, these people may have a plaque, an unstable plaque, one of these atherosclerotic plaques that just ruptures. And, you know, but in general, there's no question that on a population basis, for most of us, I can't predict for myself, but I know that in general, the odds are if I take better care of myself, I'll have a healthier life.
Yeah, the odds are, exactly.
Yeah.
Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740, Zoomer Radio.
Multitasking here. 8 new donors for the Cancer Walk. Thank you very much. I will mention your names before the walk. I'm making a careful note. I thank you all very much for that. Now let's get right to Dr. Zach. All our lines are full, Dr. Zach, so let's get to the questions. Here's Arel calling from Oshawa. Arel, do you have a question for Dr. Zach?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon, Dale.
Hi.
Dr. Zach.
Hello.
Dr. Zach, you had referred to smoking and the effects on our health and, of course, lung cancer. My wife and I often discuss this subject, and we're wondering, what effects does marijuana have on the body or the lungs? Is there any correlation between that and smoking?
Good question.
Yeah, thanks for your question, Arel. So, and I'm actually glad you brought it up, because I heard Dale talking before about that study, and I thought it was very interesting. And I used to go around, I used to go around speaking to schools, to young people about marijuana use and drug use, and I thought it was an interesting study. So the studies certainly are not there. When you look at marijuana and health and lung cancer and other forms of cancer, there certainly isn't the volume of studies, and there isn't the volume of people who have used the same amount as compared to tobacco smoking. There's certainly suggestions that the use of marijuana and any kind of inhaled smoke does increase your risk for lung disease and lung cancer. But because people don't usually use the same amount, and because they haven't done great studies, they haven't been able to say, as far as I've read so far, that it's the, like, whether it's worse, whether it's the same, or whether it's not as bad. But I think there's clear evidence. What we do know is there's clear evidence that inhaling smoke, whether it be other things aside from tobacco, including marijuana, it does increase your risk for some lung disease, including cancer. However, because the amounts are definitely less, people who smoke marijuana certainly don't have the same risk as someone who smokes, say, a pack a day of cigarettes, just because it's the amount of smoke that actually enters the lungs. The other thing worth noting, just because I'm thinking about marijuana, is that it's certainly not safe. It doesn't get talked about. We hear so much about drinking and driving, you know, but we don't talk about the use of marijuana and driving. But yeah, it definitely affects your reflexes and your mental faculties, and it's definitely not safe to use marijuana and then drive.
Thank you very much, RL, for the question. Here's Glenn in North York. Glenn, do you have a question?
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon. Yes, I'm really concerned about having a heart condition that actually having a couple of heart attacks, three or four heart attacks, as verified by a cardiologist through ECGs. My father's feet were turning blue due to poor circulation. When he did the ECG, the cardiologist said that he had suffered three heart attacks.
Yeah.
He is underweight. He is slim. He's no low cholesterol. He's not in any condition for a heart attack. So congenital, and so therefore the cardiologist prescribed for him statin drugs, which I think is very wrong.
Mm. Why?
Why?
Are you a doctor?
Oh no, but through my own research, why would a doctor prescribe a hypocholesterolemia drug for somebody that doesn't have high cholesterol?
Oh, well, I see your point then. Dr. Zach, any thoughts on that?
Well, it's a very interesting question. What I like is, you know, I think it's important that Glenn is questioning things. I think it's a good idea to research these things.
I know that statin drugs are the number one drugs in the world, and there's a lot behind those drugs.
Yep. Yeah, no, absolutely, and certainly there's a lot of, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is strong, and so it's worth questioning these things. I mean, there is, as I'm sure you know, there's good evidence that controlling cholesterol, especially in secondary prevention, so that's what this is here, basically someone who's known to have heart condition, cardiovascular disease.
But there's not. It's a congenital heart defect because there's no symptoms.
Right. But a heart attack, you know, usually congenital heart disease refers to the structure of the heart as opposed to heart attacks being caused by actual blockage of the arteries.
My father never knew he had heart attacks until he went to his cardiologist, and through ECGs, he had certain dead cells, and the doctor figured out that he had three heart attacks.
In the past,
suggest to him or recommend or prescribe for him statin drugs to lower his cholesterol. Saying that, he's also lowering some other vital nutrients that his heart needs.
All right. Glenn, thank you very much for your call. Any final thoughts on that, Dr. Zach?
Well, it's not an easy thing, but certainly if someone's had heart attacks and they've been asymptomatic, it is the doctor's job to try and find what risk factors they have that can be controlled. And so I think Glenn's referring to there is some genetic component there, but the doctor seems to feel that the cholesterol could be contributing. And, you know, it's worth discussing with, if you have a concern like that, you can discuss it with the doctor. But I would hope there's some reason behind the use.
Well, that's the shape and form of medical care these days, that you have a family member in the hospital, that you also have a hospital buddy who from time to time can ask those kinds of questions and get some good answers.
Absolutely. And, the job of the doctor is to try and figure out what they can do to prevent this from happening again.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's subtle, you know. Sometimes it's not that obvious.
Here's Jane on the line. Jane, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you for taking my call. I've heard that severe stress does terrible things to your body, and I wondered, how does stress affect your cardiovascular system? And if it does, what kind of doctor would you go to, and what test would you get to determine the damage?
Okay.
Great. So thanks for your question, Jane. So, you know, it's very interesting. Stress more and more, it's gone both ways. I think more and more we are appreciating that stress does have a significant role to play in your physiological health. You know, that we used to say, oh, there's mental health and there's physical health, and now we're realizing that they're one and the same. At the same time, some things that we used to think were completely caused by stress, like ulcers, like stomach ulcers, we used to think, oh, that's all stress.
Yeah.
And now we found that there's something called H. pylori, and there's a bacterial component. So there's a complex interplay there. But there's certainly evidence, to answer your question, that stress does increase your risk for certain diseases, including cardiovascular disease. And there's evidence that if you are under a lot of stress, that your risk for atherosclerosis can go up. And so you do have somewhat of an increase in risk for heart attack and stroke and those sorts of nasty things, and increased blood pressure. So how do you get tested for it? And who would you see about it? I would honestly say you would start with your family doctor if you have one, or whichever doctor you can see, because stress is a very general term, and you have to get to the bottom. First of all, you might know if you have it. There are some tests that your doctor can do, just cognitive tests and discussing tests, to see what your level of stress are, and these are actual scales, like things that you can check off and fill out. There's not really specific like blood tests. There are tests for inflammation, something we've talked about before, which is the CRP and inflammation, but that's not a stress test. Stress really in and of itself is something that you get to with discussion. And in terms of treatment, it ultimately depends on the cause of the stress. So first you determine that you have too much stress, then you determine what the cause is, and then there's a number of effective treatments available depending on what the cause is. And certainly one of the things that does help, I know I sound like a broken record, but certainly regular physical activity is one of the effective non-medicinal treatments for stress.
All right, thank you very much, Jane, for that question. Are there some, as well, doctor, are there some positive aspects to stress?
Yes, I would say there are. I mean, I think the total lack. Well, sometimes people will come in and they're feeling down or they're feeling blue and they want to take some time off and sometimes people do need to take time off for whatever reason from work. But one of the things I have found is that the total absence of anything to do and the total absence of some stress to keep people going is not necessarily a positive thing. We need something to motivate us.
Yeah.
And stress is actually, it's like a bell curve. Up to a certain point, it's helpful. It motivates us. It keeps us active.
Gets you going, yeah.
It gets us going. But after you get to the top of that curve, you start to go down the other side, and that's when it becomes damaging. Once your stress is actually becoming a hindrance to your performance, so you have so much stress that you're not able to do the things that your stress is supposed to be motivating you to do, then you need to step back and control the stress itself somehow.
Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740, Zoomer Radio.
You may have heard it just before the commercial. My cell phone continues to chirp away. Marking new donations to the Princess Margaret Hospital with that special walk coming up next weekend. Thank you. Let's get back to Dr. Zach. And we have Pauline on the line from Toronto. Pauline, do you have a question?
Yes, I have. question for the doctor.
Okay.
I broke my hip just about a year ago, less a month. My feet have been swollen ever since. I can't find shoes anywhere to wear. I can't walk out by myself anymore. And I've wondered if there's anything I can take.
For the swollen feet, right?
I've been to hospitals, but never did anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely, there's something you can take. It depends. Anyway, I mean, first of all, Pauline, I'm really sorry about the broken hip, but unfortunately it's very common,
yes,
and it can lead to very, you know, severe morbidity. People do have a long recovery afterwards, but I'm glad you're getting around. In terms of the foot swelling, there are definitely treatments available. It depends somewhat on the cause. So sometimes it's from generally fluid retention in the body and the heart not pumping enough, in which case there are medications, there are diuretics, water pills that can be used. And other times, if it's more of a problem with the veins, then oftentimes compression stockings, even though in the summer it's not very comfortable, for sure, it can be very hot, but those can be helpful in terms of decreasing the amount of water pressure that's causing the feet to be swollen. So I think you said you've already consulted for it, but I would reconsult because a doctor has to figure out the cause for it, and then because the answer is yes, there are definitely treatments for it. They just have to determine exactly what the nature of the problem is first.
It would be great to get up and around, wouldn't it, Pauline?
Well, it would. I'm by myself.
Yeah. Well, you have your daughter to help you.
Well, yeah, she's pushing me to live with her.
Yeah, she is. She's still
and,
doing that.
I'm
all
getting
right.
to the point now. I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
To move in with them.
Okay, Pauline. Pauline, may I say it's very nice to hear your voice.
It's nice to talk to you.
Okay. Bye for.
I listen to you all the time.
Well, that's good. Thank you very much, Pauline. Pauline, Dr. Zach is one of our double Zoomers. If you do the math, you know what I'm saying.
That's wonderful, and she's doing the right thing. You know, she's trying to be active, and you know, after a hip fracture, it's very important. A lot of people don't do that, and that's a big problem. So, she has to keep being active, and go back to the doctor and see what can be done about these swollen feet. Something can be done.
Yeah, here's Connie from Hamilton. Connie, do you have a question for Dr.
Zach? Yes, I do. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask Dr. Zach if there is any treatment or medication for atherosclerosis.
So atherosclerosis, I'm glad you brought it up. So just to clarify, I think I mentioned earlier, so what is atherosclerosis? It's basically an accumulation of these fatty deposits on the artery wall.
Mm-hmm.
And there's LDL in there, which is the bad cholesterol. There is an inflammatory component. And so the answer to your question, is there a medication to take against atherosclerosis? There's no specific medication against atherosclerosis, actually. The medications that are available are things to decrease the things that increase your risk for atherosclerosis. So the things that increase your risk for atherosclerosis are diabetes, hypertension or high blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, which is high cholesterol. So all those things there are treatments for. But once you have the plaque, once you have the plaque in the arteries, and by the way, these can be anywhere. We often think, oh, it's primarily in the heart, but these can be in the coronary arteries of the heart. They can be in the femoral, which is in the groin. It can be in the carotid arteries, which are in the neck, and it can even be in the brain arteries. And unfortunately, there's no specific medication to get rid of the plaques once the plaques are there. There are treatments now, as I'm sure you've heard about, there are angiograms that we do, so we can look in the artery, and they can stent open arteries that are too narrow from these plaques, but there aren't medications specific for it. All there are the medications to treat the risk factors for developing the atherosclerosis. And unfortunately, very often we don't know that we have atherosclerosis until there is a symptom. You know, until there's a heart attack or until there's some strain, some ischemia, like we have some pain in our leg when we walk. Then we get a test, and we see there's some narrowing of the arteries.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but one thing that's quite interesting is what we found recently is this actually begins quite early in life, atherosclerosis. It starts even in the teen years. So, and lifestyle, you know, lifestyle is important all the way from when we're kids all the way up to our later years. So You may have it or you may not, and there's no. The other thing, sorry to talk so much, but there's no...
That's why we bring you on the radio, Dr. Zach. Don't worry.
You know, I tell you, I just find it so interesting. I keep going on. But there's no, you know, there's no real screening for it. You know, we don't do angiograms just on any patient who comes in because, you know, there's some risk to doing an angiogram. The other ways you can test for it are that's less invasive. There's, for the heart, I'm sure people have heard of stress tests where you get on the treadmill, and that's a less sensitive test, and there are also CT scans, but... In general, we don't screen for atherosclerosis, but we screen for all the risk factors for atherosclerosis. So if you have those controlled, then you've done a good job in hopefully protecting yourself from atherosclerosis. Or just in case, basically atherosclerosis, arterial sclerosis, and hardening of the arteries are all pretty much the same thing. If someone says those things, they're referring to the same disease process.
All right. Connie, thanks very much.
Got it. There is no treating it.
Well, there's controlling the risk factors, but there's no there's no medication specifically to remove the plaques, unfortunately, right now.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Connie, very much for the question.
Much.
All right.
Thanks.
Here's Bud in Muskoka. Bud, what's your question?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm 86 years old. I've worked hard all my life, but I'm slowly losing muscle in my biceps. Mm. I'm right-handed, but I've lost more muscle in my left side than I have in my right.
Mm. And you want to know why?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it can be from a few things. I mean, certainly there's no question that your muscle mass does, it is harder to maintain your muscle mass as you get a bit older, but it's not impossible, but it definitely is much easier to bulk up in your whatever, in your 20s and 30s than it is when you're in your 80s. The best thing, so there's a couple of things you can do. Now, first of all, I do think it's always, you know, I'm just on the phone, I don't know you, I can't see you. I think it's certainly worthwhile consulting with your physician and seeing if there's anything else going on, because there are sometimes if the nerve is not conducting properly to the muscle, we need, in order for a muscle to stay strong and to stay big, it needs to be stimulated all the time to twitch, you know, the muscle fiber has to be stimulated. So it's worthwhile getting it checked out. If you determine that, you know, it's just happening, it's just, you know, because of age or whatnot and everything's working properly, the only things you can do really are, number one, is stay active as you're doing, which is great, including muscle strengthening exercises, and then have a diet that includes enough carbohydrates and protein, the building blocks of muscle, basically. So eat lots of, fish and nuts and things that would help build the muscle.
But the muscle on my left arm is just a bag of flesh.
Yeah. And you still, are you able to flex it? Are you able to?
Oh, yeah, I can use it in that.
Well, flexing is called for then, right?
Well, flexing would definitely...
It's pretty hard to exercise when you're 86.
Well, but it's not impossible, Bud.
No, but you have so many things that you do. I'm quite active. I boat and everything.
Yeah.
I have a boat and stuff like that.
It's great.
Like, I'm not just sitting in the sun.
Good man.
Absolutely. So keep that up, and I think it's still worthwhile to check it out with your doctor and keep working the muscles.
Yeah.
Okay,
all
thanks
right.
A lot.
Thanks very much, Bud. Bye. Okay. Yeah, you can exercise at any age. I mean, it's as long as you have movement and you can fight back against that muscle loss by trying to build it up, right?
Well, absolutely. Something you mentioned before, we were talking about like psychological stress, but the other kind of stress that we need is muscle stress. You know, the way we build muscle is with resistance. So we have to stress our muscles a bit if we want them to maintain their strength.
Okay, here's Bonnie on the line. Bonnie, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I went for a CT scan. On the bottom part of my lungs, I have what they call white cells sitting on the bottom of my lungs, and they recommend I don't get another x-ray for a year because I've had too much radiation. So they said check back in a year and we'll check the white cells and sitting on the bottom of your lungs. What exactly is that?
Well, I have to say, Bonnie, it's interesting. Like, it's not a typical finding, because usually they describe what they see, but white cells usually when doctors say white cells, usually that refers to white blood cells. So that's why I'm a little I don't really know how they would know it was exactly white blood cells unless they took some tissue, which it doesn't sound like they did.
No, like it was like white, okay, white, like shadowing sitting on the bottom of my lung.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
And, sorry.
All right.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure. The other thing is, and by the way, I get these all the time. I get X-ray reports, CT scan reports, where they see possible nodules or possible basically shadowing or increased density at the bottom of the lungs. And they will, and oftentimes they don't know exactly what it is, but one of the things, the radiologists these days are quite good at determining if it's something they're worried about. So usually if they're worried about it, they will say, this absolutely needs to be biopsied, or you need a repeat test to look at it right away, or otherwise, if they think it's likely more benign, they will recommend something like they recommended for you, which is to have another imaging test in another year just to see if there's been any change. But I think you could get, usually they're able to give you a little more of an impression as to what they think it might be, or at least reassure you a bit if, because it sounds like if they're just saying, well, don't do anything for a year, then they're relatively reassured that it's not something bad, but they're giving you much more information.
You need a little more information.
However,
Bonnie,
if you notice a difference in your physical behavior, like my breathing is getting a little tight and it seems to be down past the diaphragm, so is it something I should be concerned about?
Well, when I get these results, if someone has breathing difficulties and there's an abnormality on the lung scan, I will usually ask a respirologist, which is a lung specialist or a pulmonologist, for their opinion, just because if you're having lung symptoms, even if you didn't have this finding on the scan, the symptoms should be explained and treated as necessary.
All right. Thank you, Bonnie, very much for the question. Dr. Zach, thanks for all the great advice.
Thanks, Dale. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye for now.
Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740, Zoomer Radio.